Previously on Beta.
Hi, I'm Norm MacDonald, and you're listening to the Beta Sizzle Reel.
This makes him a frightening, but also a very attractive figure.
And that mess is you.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Who's your favorite character on The Simpsons? Lisa? Bart? Comic book guy? One of my favorites is Apu. He's the guy who works at the Quickie Mart convenience store in Springfield. Or is he the owner? It's never quite clear, is it? But it doesn't really matter. What we do know is that Apu is friendly, kind, and thoughtful. But ever since I watched comedian Hari Kondabolu's documentary, The Problem with Apu, I've had a little change of heart. You'll find out why later in the program. Also, prepare yourself for some queasy listening as we're going to talk about awkwardness and things will probably get a bit awkward. But first, a heartbreaking but hopeful story of addiction, grief, and family.
What's the deal with that hot girl, April?
What's the deal with her?
Yeah, like, she good to go? Like, she down to clown?
She's married. She got married like 20 minutes ago.
Oh my God, that's the same girl from the thing.
From the wedding ceremony, yeah.
All the good ones are taken, huh, bro?
Yeah.
That's a clip from the sitcom Parks and Recreation, featuring Harris Whittles as Harris, the animal control expert. Whittles died from a heroin overdose on February 19, 2015. He was one of the hottest comedy writers in the industry. He wrote for the hit NBC comedy series Parks and Rec, Comedy Central's The Sarah Silverman Show, and he even wrote a few jokes for President Obama. And he did it all before he turned 30 years old. In the wake of his death, many comedians honored Harris. And now his sister, Stephanie Whittles Wax, has released a raw and unflinching memoir called Everything is Horrible and Wonderful. It's a frank look at her struggles to come to terms with the loss of her little brother, Harris.
I always say he accomplished more in 8 years than any of us will accomplish in a lifetime.
Yeah.
He was the most successful person I've ever known.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm his older sister, so
yeah.
I didn't take credit for that. He, you know, from the time Harris could speak, he was making jokes, and he always was funny, and he always wanted to be funny, and he knew that's exactly what he wanted to do. And when he was 18 and he was old enough to get into the comedy club here in Houston, he would go and do open mics. And for his last semester of college, he moved out to LA to do an internship with Comedy Central.
Yeah.
And he continued to do open mics. And when he was 22, Sarah Silverman caught him at one and sent him an email a few months later asking in this truly humble way. She is genuinely a terrific human being.
Mm-hmm.
Asking if he would want to be a writer on her show and apologizing, you know, if this isn't what you want to do, don't worry about it. No worries, no hard feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he's 22 and has idolized her, you know, since.
So it's like a dream job. Yeah,
it's
getting a dream
job
when you're only 22 years old. Yeah.
Oh, no, I'm a nobody. I'm just a huge fan of yours.
Really?
Yeah, is that okay?
It's great.
Yeah, so he went in and started working on the Sarah Silverman program.
Wow.
And 2 years later, moved on to Parks and Recreation on NBC. And in the interim, I mean, he climbed up the ranks at Parks and Recreation to eventually be a co-executive producer. He was a recurring character on the show, Harris, mm-hmm. the animal control guy.
Right.
Welcome to Animal Control. Let me show you around. Those are some chairs. That's a cat or possum. Oh, this is a napkin where I wrote down a cool name for a dog. Bark Obama.
He coined the term humble brag and wrote a book about it.
Yeah, and the book, of course, is called, appropriately enough, Humble Brag, The Art of False Modesty. What's the origin story behind Harris's invention of that word?
Being frustrated with everyone in L.A. He was noticing this trend of people, you know, boasting about things, but in this way that was really self-deprecating.
Yeah.
And he started a Twitter feed where he would call people out and retweet them as like the humble brag police of the internet. And it became this thing that resonated with so many people because we hear people do this all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I was going on the Seth Meyers show. He was kind enough to have me on
his
show.
Yeah, I saw you on that. You were great.
Well, thank you. And I'm very pregnant. So if I were to say, I'm going on Seth Meyers, but I don't know what I'm going to wear. I'm so fat and pregnant right now. That is a humble brag.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
I'm bragging about something, but I'm doing it in a way that, you know, is self-deprecating.
Right. Yeah, Harris also wrote jokes for President Obama, right?
He did so many things. He wrote for Between Two Ferns with Zach Galifianakis. Mm-hmm. And the episode that Obama was on, he used some of Harris's jokes.
It must kind of stink, though, that you can't run, you know, three times.
No, actually, I think it's a good idea. If I ran a third time, it'd be sort of like doing a third Hangover movie. Didn't really work out very well, did it?
He was a prolific podcaster. He also worked for Eastbound and Down. Mm-hmm. He was a writer on Master of None, the Emmy Award-winning show with Aziz Ansari.
Yeah, he was supposed to appear. He was just, when he died, he was on the verge of, like, moving to New York to work on that show, and he was also going to appear in it as well, wasn't he?
He was. He was cast as Aziz's best friend, Harris. Mm-hmm. He had to audition for himself, which was hilarious and caused a fair amount of stress.
Yeah, and he didn't get one of those things like, you're not Harris Whittles enough for us.
Right.
Right. Good, that's good.
He literally wrote the part and named it Harris, and then he had to audition for it.
Right.
And if you've seen the show, it's the role that Eric Wareheim ended up playing.
Oh, right, of Tim and Eric fame. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So why do you think Harris was so funny? Why was he able to be so funny?
I mean, again, I will take credit for it.
Yeah, as well you should. Congratulations. And thank you for teaching him to be so funny on behalf
of
all of us.
We come from a family where you had to be funny to survive. It was like part of the rules. If you aren't funny, you have to leave.
Yeah. Your dad's very funny, right?
He's totally bizarre. Strange human being. Very strange.
Yeah.
And, we just kind of were raised with that, and I think genetically and also just, everyone has the personality they have. Harris viewed the world with this lens of humor, and that's just who he was from the beginning.
When did you learn that Harris was a drug addict?
Oh, he called me and told me this news. I was in Houston, he was in L.A., and it happened to be 3 days before my wedding.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's not the kind of news when you're stressed out as it is, getting ready for your wedding. How did you react when he told you that?
I tried to stay calm. Mm-hmm. I tried to be supportive. I didn't want to jump to judgment or to make him feel like he couldn't confide in me.
Mm-hmm.
We had a very open relationship. We told each other everything. And so I wanted him to feel safe talking to me about this. At the same time, it was tough because he also made me promise I wouldn't tell my parents. And so I was put in this really difficult position, which he would continue to put me in, where I was protecting him, but then in protecting him, was I also threatening him in terms of his life? And it was tough. It was a really hard time.
Yeah, yeah. So yet, despite that, even in when you're in this really dark time, you were still able, you still had your sense of humor. You made that funny joke about if Harris wasn't already dead, I'd kill him. Yeah.
Yeah, it's, people will read the book and they'll say, how are you so funny still? And I don't know. I think when something really tragic happens, you're still you.
Mm-hmm.
You're still moving through the world as yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So part of being myself is that I have a sense of humor. And I also think that during times that are so awful, as human beings, we make jokes because we're going to die if we don't. I mean, it's I think it's what keeps us from jumping off bridges, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, I always say, I can pause for a second and make this joke and I can come right back to my grief. It's not going anywhere.
No.
It's still going to be right there for me.
Yeah.
I can pick it up anytime I want.
Yeah.
And the jokes, you know, they were fewer and far between, of course, but there are these moments of levity that come through, especially when you have a baby,
mm-hmm.
because they're funny.
Yeah, exactly. Especially young Iris sounds like she's exceptionally funny. She's a real character, yeah.
She blends into the family well.
Yeah, there you go. you and your mother attended the Emmy Awards 7 months after Harris died. Parks and Recreation was nominated for Best Comedy Series, and Harris was honored during the In Memoriam segment. What do you remember most about that experience?
I was really frustrated with my mom for the bulk of that experience, and mostly because she was so excited to go, and I was so not excited to go. And, you know, we had this little tiff while we were there, and I told her, you know, Mom, this isn't a vacation for me. We're going because Harris died. This isn't something that I want to do. And, you know, we kind of hashed that out. And once I got there and I was in the midst of his friends and colleagues and I was in the midst of hearing about all the amazing things that he did and talking and celebrating the work of this incredible show, my ambivalence about it shifted to joy, where I felt really proud of him and I felt like this is a way that we can honor him.
Mm-hmm.
Because the couple of years leading up to Harris's death were really tumultuous and tragic and hard, but the rest of his life wasn't. He was funny and he worked really hard and he produced a lot of incredible stuff. And my goal is always to continue to celebrate that. So it ended up being a really positive experience that I expected to be a really negative experience.
Yeah.
I also just don't like getting dressed as a person. I've gotten really dressed up for my wedding, obviously.
Obviously.
And then second to that, the Emmys, you know. But I'm a jeans and t-shirt kind of a gal.
Mm-hmm.
So it just stresses me out to have to look my best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. But so in retrospect, you were glad that you went with your mom. It was good to
go. It was really good. In retrospect, I'm glad that she bullied me into going. Yes.
Excellent. About 3 months before Harris died, you had this really kind of weird experience where you were listening to the comedian Pete Holmes' podcast, You Made It Weird, on which Harris was a guest. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, that was a bad day. I was listening to him. It was a really long podcast. It was a couple of hours. And he was explaining the ins and outs and intricacies of his heroin addiction and how it started and how he would get it and how he had a mini overdose at this particular time and all of these things that I didn't know that he had hidden from me. And I was learning all of this as he said it to this guy I didn't know and as it was being aired to the world.
Wow.
And the real issue with that is that he had already relapsed by that time and nobody knew that. Oh. So he was talking about how he understands what's at stake for him. He was saying, if he goes out again, he's going to destroy his family. He, you know, all of these things. And I knew he already had done it.
Oh, dear. Yeah.
So I was really, really angry with him.
Oh, yeah.
After hearing that.
Hmm. Harris's death was not just something that you and your family had to deal with privately. It was also something that people were grieving about publicly and quote-unquote liking on Facebook. How did this public outpouring of grief over your brother's death affect you and your family?
I think that Facebook and social media can be a really difficult place to be when you're going through something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody's posting their best selves,
yeah,
their most wonderful moments.
Yeah.
And you're stuck in your worst moment.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was hard for me in general to engage with the internet during that time. But there was a sense of comfort that I had that everybody was talking about Harris. Mm-hmm. You know, it meant that we were not alone, that we were in this together. And then what happened is what happens on the internet with trending topics, which is that they end and people move on to the next story. Mm-hmm. And when that happened, it was devastating because we were still stuck there. Yeah. How can you move on to, at that time, it was Leonard Nimoy from Star Trek that had died.
Yeah.
And everybody moved on to him as the dead celebrity of the week.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, this is sick. This is really sick. And these are news stories to these people, and this is a quarter of my family.
Yeah.
So it was tough. It was tough. And, you know, everything, there's shades of gray with all of this, because while it was frustrating, I've gotten the most beautiful artwork from strangers on the internet who have mailed me these gorgeous portraits of my brother. And, you know, people loved him. And I think now that I'm not stuck in that acute place of grief, I can appreciate that more.
Well, that's good. That's very good.
Yeah.
Yeah. You inherited Harris's phone, which contained all kinds of photos and his notes for jokes and stand-up sets. This seems to me like kind of a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it preserves a lot of memories of your brother. But on the other hand, having this digital record of all of these memories can break your heart more often. What has it been like for you?
You know, the good thing about I have a Mac, and you just kind of load it in there, and it goes away. You know, it's stored into the crevices of that hard drive, and so when I want to see something, I can. There will be times where I'm scrolling through iPhoto, and I'll see a picture of Iris when she was a baby, and then I'll see a picture of Harris, and, you know, there have been times when I have been searching for something, a text message or an email or an interaction that we had that I'm able to find, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
So in the beginning, you know, I say I didn't turn his phone on for 2 months. It just sat in a drawer next to my bed because I wasn't ready to look at it. And so I think it's both, you know, people will say, you know, do you listen to your brother's podcasts? Never. I never do that because it's really painful.
Yeah.
To hear his voice.
Yeah, I can imagine it would be. If you don't mind me asking, are there certain things on Harris's phone that you treasure most?
I think his thoughts, having access to his notes, and his jokes and his set lists and his ideas, that's what made him so special.
Yeah.
Nobody had a brain like his. He had the most creative, inventive, limitless mind. And it's all there. So that's the stuff that I have really valued having a record of.
Yeah. Harris was a big fan of the band Fish. Did he have a favorite Fish song?
Yeah, unfortunately, that's true. It's something I'm not proud of.
Not a fan of the jam bands, eh?
This is really funny that you asked me that because one of his favorite Fish songs was Fluffhead. I mean, that's a song title. And that's like, this is such a ridiculous thing. But anyway, we've named our baby in utero Fluffhead. And I labeled his file in our file cabinet Fluffhead. And my sweet daughter would argue with us, you cannot call him Fluffhead. And I was like, listen, I can call him whatever I want. He's in my stomach. When you have a baby in your stomach, you make these decisions. And so her teachers would say, you're having a baby named Fluffhead, you know?
Yeah.
And I'd be like, yeah, I am.
Yeah.
Deal with it.
Yeah.
Fluffhead was a man with a horrible disease. Could not find no cure. Won't you help?
Stephanie Whittles Wax is the older sister of the late comedian and writer Harris Whittles. Her memoir is called Everything is Horrible and Wonderful. For more information on Stephanie's book and Harris, click over to wpr.org/beta. Coming up, we check in with comedian Hari Kondabolu to learn more about his documentary, The Problem with Apu. That's next on Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcome back to Beta. I'm Doug Gordon. Do you remember a time when The Simpsons wasn't on television? Me neither. It's now in its 29th season. One of my favorite Simpsons characters is the guy who runs Springfield's convenience store, the Quickie Mart. His name is Apu. Comedian Hari Kondabolu has a problem with Apu. And after I watched Hari's documentary, I have to admit that I'm not such a big Apu fan either.
We've had an amazing run the last few years with more Indians in the public eye than ever before. There's like 14 of us now. There's now enough Indian people where I don't need to like you just because you're Indian. Because growing up, I had no choice but to like this.
Serving the customer is merriment enough for me. Thank you, come again.
Hey, Ganesha, want a peanut?
Please do not offer my god a peanut. You stealing squishies? Please pay for your purchases and get out and come again.
Oh, no, it is encrusted with filth. Oh, well, let's sell it anyway. Now this is just between me and you.
Part of the problem is, at that time in particular, how few representations there were of South Asians and a lot of other groups. And so the few representations there are extremely important. But then, that begs the question, who's in control of those representations? And often they're not the people from the communities. Like, there were no brown people making Apu, right? Those are white comedy writers, white executives, white voice actor.
Yeah.
And so that's clearly a problem, the idea of being depicted without your say. And then, there's a lineage in this country. There's a history in this country, I should say, a history of poor racial representation, of caricatures, of minstrelsy. You know, this stems back a long time in this country. And Apu is part of that greater lineage. I don't think it's the same as black minstrelsy. I think there's a very different racial history there, but certainly it's in that same line. Mm-hmm. And I think, we can acknowledge those things are problems, and I feel like this is, is in the same line.
Yeah. At one point in your film, you say, this is all we had. Apu reflected how America viewed us, servile, devious, goofy.
Yes.
Yeah. A lot of the characters on The Simpsons are stereotypes. There's the Italian chef, and there's Willie, the Scottish groundskeeper. Why is Apu offensive, but these other Simpsons characters are not?
I mean, the word offensive is tricky just because, I was never offended.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Like, right,
it didn't offend my sensibility. It was more insulting.
Insulting. Okay. So then why is Apu insulting?
It's insulting because, first of all, it's not the best representation just based on he's heavily accented in an inauthentic accent. And he's in this position of service, never being able to move upward. Those are not necessarily the most positive things. The difference between that and, let's say, the Italian representation or groundskeeper Willie is that, there's many other Italian representations. There's other Scottish representations. And also the thing in America is that, those ethnic identities end up turning into whiteness. So, mm-hmm. We don't have that.
Yeah.
We don't have that kind of, other identity where we can be identified. It's basically, especially at that time, it was the, ridiculous Indian immigrant, and that stood in for all of us. I mean, if we lived in a culture where there was equal opportunities for representation, then equal opportunity offense is fair. But when you don't get to talk back, it's like, hitting somebody with their arms tied behind their back.
That raises the question, if Apu's character was voiced by a South Asian actor, would you still find Apu insulting?
Yeah, because it's a bad part.
Yeah.
Like, the character and the writing is what it is, right? So you could say it's one less degree because it doesn't completely fall in line with the white guy, brown paint aspect of it. But it's still, and we speak about this in the film, it's a brown voice actor, a brown actor being, being forced to choose between, do I feel good about this and will I get paid?
One of the first movies I did was a movie called Van Wilder with Ryan Reynolds, and I played an Indian exchange student. And I remember very clearly getting a phone call from my agent at the time, and she said, hey, I've got this audition for you. It's a supporting lead in a movie. She goes, okay, the character's name is Taj Mahal.
I'm Taj Mahal.
And I hung up the phone, and she calls me back. She's like, I knew you were going to do that. I'm like, well, yeah. I mean, I didn't major in theater and film to play Taj Mahal.
Right.
And she said, look, it's almost impossible for me to sell you without any credits, any legitimate credits on your resume. And I know that you probably won't want to do something like this, but I would really strongly urge you to take a look at it.
That is a choice that many different actors have had to make for quite some time. Like, you want a career in this art form, but, you know, you're viewed in this very skewed way, especially with TV and film. So, yeah, it changes. I don't know if it makes it better, but it changes the dynamic.
You talked with many of your fellow South Asian actors about Apu. What did they say about the character?
It was kind of a shared, you know, it was a shared phenomenon, which I knew, which is part of the reason I wanted to make the film. There was a lot of people who had the exact same experiences of, you know, this is a voice they heard growing up. They were mocked with it. As actors, they were told to do that particular voice because that's the, you know, because Hollywood isn't that creative and they want the same thing that's effective over and over again. And the Indian accent's funny, so do the Apu version of it.
How would you define patanking if you were to explain what that means?
Patanking is being asked to speak in a broad Indian accent with broad acting.
They want the accent to sound like this and they want your tongue to be really pulled back.
So patanking was going into a room and having to do that exact thing in front of people like a monkey.
So is that something that Hank Azaria is guilty of? Is he patanking in the way he voices Apu?
I don't think it's patanking just because he's not South Asian.
Right,
so
yeah.
For him, it's not like a, you know, it's straight, you know, clowning a group of people. And he got paid to do it. And certainly, like, at the time, the environment around these things was very different, you know. Like, people didn't find this an issue because nobody was there to complain. And the people who were complaining, nobody wanted to hear them and they were outnumbered. And so, you know, that's, you know, it's kind of a standard move. I mean, to be honest, even back then, I'm sure that the Indian accent is hacky. It's cliched. It's an easy laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And for The Simpsons, it kind of is weird because it just feels like, oh, my God, the show is so much smarter than this.
Yeah. And at one point in your documentary, you say that to understand your quest to get rid of Apu, we need to understand the complicated and diverse experiences of South Asian Americans in this country.
Right.
What is it that we need to understand?
That, you know, we have to understand that the idea of Indian Americans is very broad. Like, this is a singular experience that they're mocking of the Indian immigrant. It's a very broad experience, even from Indian to Pakistani to Sri Lankan to Bangladeshi. You know, you have so many different histories and religions and languages and cultures, and it's so much more complicated than what is depicted. And, you know, you have this one character representing a whole generation, essentially. And it's this white dude doing a voice of a male convenience store owner. And meanwhile, you know, how many stories don't get told?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
like, yeah.
You know, all the different people with different identities, you know, and all their identities intersect to be able to share their stories, right? Like, I want to see, like, a brown queer woman be able to share her story, you know, versus, you know, somebody else playing that part and writing that script. You know, and honestly, it's not just progress and fairness, it's more interesting. Like, everyone's, you know, in entertainment is looking for the next big thing. What is the new thing we haven't done yet? And unfortunately, you know, and maybe fortunately for the creators of the art, the new thing is the old thing. It's the old thing that we weren't allowed to share. I mean, this Apu movie is old to me, right? The ideas are old. I've known this since I was 15 or 16. But what makes it interesting is that I get to share it. And I get to speak to people, and I get to tell people what happened, and I wasn't allowed to before. There's a generation that wasn't allowed to talk back.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really what's really exciting about now.
Yeah, for sure. The Simpsons introduced Apu's nephew, Jamshed, or Jay, in a 2016 episode called Much Apu About Something. And you talked to the actor Utkarsh Ambudkar, am I saying his name right?
That's right.
Yeah, who voiced this character. What did he say about that experience?
I mean, he was very excited. Utkarsh is also a Simpsons fan like I was growing up. And also this character was a really exciting possibility, right? Like, oh, finally we get a voice. And at the end he was disappointed because he felt like, did we really have a voice or was this a token Indian American character to just meet the complaints that people have recently heard that this character, you know, this Apu character is messed up? And was it just, you know, did they use me to get to that end?
There's a moment where I'm like bashing Apu and I'm like, you're a stereotype. Why do you talk like that? And I had an alt where I was like, you sound like a white guy doing a bad version of an Indian accent. I'll say that. And then you cut to the real Hank Azaria in the booth.
That's so good.
Look and have him look at the camera.
So good.
And then cut back to the cartoon.
That like solves the thing. Did you do the take?
I did, but they weren't having it.
Was there ever a moment of second guessing, or was there ever a moment of regret? Maybe I shouldn't have, like maybe I'm taking them off the hook by doing this. Like, was there ever that?
Oh yeah, when I watched it.
Really?
Well, yeah, I mean, The Simpsons wins. Hmm. I wanted to win.
That makes me wonder, do you think this was the writer's, producer's way of trying to make an apology for Apu?
I don't know if it's an apology, but it's at least an acknowledgement.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah.
Because what's the point of an apology if nothing changes?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and it's not to say you need to kill Apu or anything. I mean, there's creative solutions, whether it's like giving him a new job, whether it's, you know, giving him other layers, or he's decided to own multiple Quickie Marts, and because that's often what happens. If we're going to say that there's some truth in stereotypes, well, the full truth is a lot of South Asian folks who do work in convenience stores end up buying the store and buying other stores. Like, it becomes a franchise, you know. Yeah. That's the part that gets left out.
Yeah, and the main through line in your film is your quest to talk to Hank Azaria, the voice of Apu, but he wouldn't talk to you. Why not?
I think he felt uncomfortable about the fact that I controlled the edit.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, whatever I was going to say, whatever he was going to be interviewed about, I was going to choose how to edit it. And that was frustrating, you know, just because, you know, I say this in the film, like, the idea that you get to choose. Like, the idea that you get to choose how you want to be seen. I don't get to choose how I want to be seen. Like, you know?
Yeah, exactly. That's a good point, yeah. In an email that Hank Azaria sent you, he said that he would be interested in reconnecting after the film is released. Now that the film has been released and has aired on True TV, have you reconnected with him? Have you reached out to him? Has he reached out to you?
No, I mean, I really, at this point, I feel like it's the ball's in his court if he wants to do it. Like, I've made a whole film about this, so I feel like I've done my part of it. But, you know, I think... When we were doing the film, I called, you know, we arranged a phone call. Hank wanted to talk to me, and he called me. This is off camera, so it wasn't actually in the film. He called me, and we had a really nice conversation, and he talked about how he liked what I was doing, and he understood why I needed to make this film. But he also said that, like, you know, he really needed to think about whether he felt comfortable with the edit, and his solution was, let's have a third party interview the both of us, or conduct the interview. So, you know, whether that was WTF with Marc Maron or Fresh Air with Terry Gross, something else that could, you know, another place where there was proof of what the interview actually was. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the idea is, well, that holds me accountable. And I said, fine. I said, absolutely. If that's what you need for us to do this, let's do it. And he still said no. I sometimes wonder, was he trying to call my bluff? And I'm like, no, I'll do it. Like, you know, I'm fine with whatever. And to be perfectly honest, I've been talking about Apu for so long. Like, if he never approached me again about it, I'm probably fine with moving on with my life.
So, oh, yeah, yeah. Sure, you got lots of stuff going on.
If he does bring it up, part of me is almost annoyed. Like, oh, now I got to talk. Yeah. It's been years. We've moved past this. Like, I got to do this again?
Yeah. A writer named Manal Faruqi wrote that your film should have also discussed Apu's wife, Manjula, because even though she wasn't as big a character as Apu was, Manjula represented South Asian women with the same tired stereotypes that have plagued them for decades. What's your response to that?
That's a very fair criticism, and I wish we had. I feel like you have a limited amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
This wasn't like a full two-hour documentary, which is honestly what I wanted to make, was a longer, more kind of academic thing. This was 49 minutes, limited amount of time.
Yeah.
I felt like we were able to talk about them broadly as immigrants and how they were represented, and you know, and Apu is the center, and he is the one that's in the show the whole time, and Manjula is you know, introduced later. But I do wish that was mentioned. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's a fair criticism. I tried to do the best I could with representation in terms of the voices we spoke, and who spoke in the film and shared their stories. But, you know, it is as a filmmaker now, I understand how hard it is to meet all the objectives you have when you go in.
Yeah.
Even if you have the footage, because there isn't enough space and time, and there's other people who have opinions as well that you have to consider. So, you know, I have nothing negative to say about that criticism. If I was able to, I would have.
Uh-huh.
And I wish I had. Yeah. And it's too late now, but it would have been nice even briefly to put that in there.
Yeah. What do you want people to take away from seeing The Problem with Apu?
I hope they see it. I think a lot of people, especially on the internet, critiqued it without ever seeing it.
Yeah.
It just became a stand-in for these larger issues about political correctness and representation that people, you know, were frustrated by, but they haven't actually seen it. And I end up countering a lot of the arguments I end up hearing after the fact. So first thing I'd say, just watch the film open-minded. I mean, like, you know, I think about it in terms of, as a comedian, no one's ever criticized The Simpsons, and it was cool to be able to make a film that is critical of The Simpsons.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a show I love. You criticize the things you love, that's okay. And also in terms of pop culture, The Simpsons makes fun of pop culture all the time. That's one of their hallmarks. So yeah. what's a bigger Simpsons move than making fun of The Simpsons?
That's comedian Hari Kondabolu. You can watch his documentary, The Problem with Apu, on True TV. Shortly after we spoke with Hari, The Simpsons finally responded to his criticism.
Well, what am I supposed to do?
It's hard to say. Something that started decades ago and was applauded and inoffensive is now politically incorrect. What can you do?
Some things will be dealt with at a later date.
If at all.
A quick update from Hari. He tweeted, quote, "Wow, politically incorrect? That's the takeaway from my movie and the discussion it sparked? Man, I really love this show. This is sad. I just want to say congratulations to The Simpsons for being talked about and being seen as relevant again." End quote. If you want to catch Hari live, he'll be performing at the Comedy Club on State in Madison on April 19th through the 21st. When we continue, the conversation will get a bit awkward.
It's an emotion that kind of reminds me of just the sheer absurdity of the human experience, you know?
We'll get cringeworthy with author Melissa Dahl. That's next on Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcome back to Beta. I'm Doug Gordon. Have you ever felt awkward? Maybe you can't stand the sound of your own voice playback.
Have you ever felt awkward? Maybe you can't stand the sound of your own voice playback.
Oh, is that what I sound like? Yikes. Or maybe you said something at a meeting once and were met with silence. That's happened to me many times. How about the time that your neighbor said hi and you responded with good? These moments of awkwardness are part of being human. I could tell you about the time that No, I can't tell that story. That's too embarrassing. Give me a second. Well, there was that time in high school when I went... No, I can't tell you that one either. Let me put it this way. My life has been an endless series of one awkward moment after another, including this one, I guess. That's why I was so excited to talk to Melissa Dahl. She's originally from Racine, Wisconsin. Melissa has written a book called Cringeworthy, A Theory of Awkwardness. How does she define awkwardness?
I've kind of defined the feeling as self-consciousness with this undercurrent of uncertainty, like, you know, I don't know what to say, I don't know what to do.
I hear you, Melissa. When she was researching her book, Melissa participated in a live event called Mortified. It's an event where adults share their most embarrassing childhood moments that they captured in their journals and diaries. Melissa read from her teenage journal. So I asked her if she could read the very same excerpt that she read in front of an audience of total strangers.
Do you know, like, how much the girl who wrote this diary just wanted someone to ask her that? Like, just talk about Hanson.
There you go. Yeah. Well, now's your chance. Yeah.
Okay, so this is from March 7th, 1998. I read this in the Mortified show.
Oh, cool.
How come no one here likes Hanson? I've been getting pictures of them off the internet almost all day today, and they're so cute. How can anyone not like them? What am I going to do? I have to call long distance if I want to talk about Hanson. I'm getting a corkboard tomorrow, and I'm going to do a whole photo collage in honor of Taylor. Yay.
Yeah, that's great. Now, reading this aloud on the radio after all these years and after you've already done it on stage, do you still feel awkward?
I was kind of looking at it before we did this interview, and it had been a while since I looked at it. You know, mm-hmm. I was kind of immersed in this stuff when I was writing the book and when I was in the show, and maybe just getting used to it made me feel a little less awkward. But reading it again now, I'm like, oh my gosh, that is pretty ridiculous.
Hanson's big hit was Mmm Bop, and as you probably know, being a big Hanson fan, that the Hanson brothers have said that the song's meaning has to do with Mmm Bop, that word representing the idea of time passing. There's that part in the song where they sing, in an Mmm Bop they're gone, in an Mmm Bop they're not there, and so it represents just things gone in an Mmm Bop. So an Mmm Bop seems to represent a very short unit of time, an instant, and yet here we are more than 20 years after Mmm Bop was originally released, and we're still talking about it. Yeah. It almost kind of undercuts the very meaning of Mmm Bop. As my fellow Canadian Alanis Morissette would say, isn't it ironic? It's like rain on your wedding day. And of course, rain on your wedding day is not really ironic. So this whole question is a bit awkward, don't you think?
No, I have been waiting 20 years for someone to ask me to analyze the lyrics of Mmm Bop. Yes, it is a brief moment in time, but it's also about comparing the people that are in your life for a minute to the people who stick around, the people who kind of do care deeply about you. I was actually reading an interview with them last year, and they said, you know, they were like kids when they wrote this, and it was about like the other kids like don't understand that like we're into music and, yeah, and there's yeah, yeah.
You talk about something in your book called the growing edge. This is a phrase I hadn't come across. What is the growing edge? What does that mean?
Yeah, the book is subtitled A Theory of Awkwardness, but it could have been like many theories of awkwardness mm-hmm. because there are all these different thoughts I had about it swirling around in my head. So if we're saying that the things that make us cringe are the things that kind of highlight that gap between the you think you're presenting to the world and the you the world is actually seeing, mm-hmm. then maybe one way to understand these moments where we feel awkward are there are moments that can, if appropriate, if we let them, they can kind of push us towards who we think we are, who we wish we were. They can push us towards that idealized version of ourselves we have in our heads. A lot of the interviews I've done about this book have focused on the things we typically call awkward, like you make a stupid joke in a meeting and nobody laughs, or like you spill coffee on yourself or have a bad hair day or something, these small moments. Mm-hmm. But as I was writing the book, I realized that we use the word to describe way more weightier things. I mean, the word has just kind of become a catch-all for anything we find uncomfortable.
Yeah.
From small things to really big things. While I was writing the book, I saw on the New York Times homepage a link that said, why we're so awkward. And so, you know, I was like, oh, I'm interested in that. So I clicked on it. And it turns out it was this video about racial bias, you know?
Yeah.
Or there's this ad campaign that's been running for several years now in the UK from this disability advocacy group called Scope. And they run these PSAs called End the Awkward, where they argue that people who don't have disabilities feel so awkward around people who do that sometimes they just avoid interacting with people who have disabilities. So the phrase your growing edge came from one of these groups that I realized that either was using the word awkward to talk about uncomfortable conversations or had the word awkward kind of put upon them. It's this group called the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond. They bring people together to have really frank, uncomfortable conversations about race and racism in the U.S., which is deeply uncomfortable.
Yeah.
That's the phrase they use. They call that discomfort, which some of us might call awkward. They call that your growing edge. They say that those moments you feel uncomfortable, it's so tempting to just check out, to kind of like, oh, I gotta go to a coffee break. I gotta, you know, I'm not coming back to this class. Or just to kind of shut down, kind of get defensive. And if you think about it, that's kind of often how we react to situations we call awkward too. We want to avoid those situations. We want to avoid uncomfortable topics. We want to avoid awkward conversations. But their whole thing is when you feel like that, that can mean potentially that you have some growing to do. That means that it could be instead of something to shut down from, instead of something to avoid, it could be an opportunity.
Yeah. So did you have a conversation while you were attending this workshop that helped you learn how to move past your growing edge?
Yeah, a lot of the people talked about just sitting with the discomfort. And I interviewed the comedian W. Kamau Bell for the book. His whole thing for years has been encouraging Americans to have more quote-unquote awkward conversations, which he defines them the same way. He defines awkward conversations as conversations about race, about gender, about class, things that make us really uncomfortable. He kind of thinks of it as like redefining what awkwardness means. It doesn't have to mean it's negative. It means uncomfortable. It means I'm going to need to listen. It means I might not be right. I might not be correct here. It means I might not like what I am seeing about this version of myself that someone else is pointing out. But not naming those things as negative, just naming them as that's just discomfort. That's part of an awkward conversation.
It's important to be able to do that, right? To move past our growing edge, especially in conversations about race.
It's hugely important. When I wrote this book, I thought about awkwardness more as an emotion, as a feeling, rather than a personality trait, which is kind of one way how we kind of talk about it as, you know, there are awkward people out there, or, oh, I'm so awkward. But I thought about it as more of a feeling that arises when you encounter something uncomfortable. If it is an emotion, and I think it is, then there is all this really cool research, kind of like new neuroscience that is coming out that's saying that the way we conceptualize an emotion actually impacts how we feel it. So if you can change the way you conceptualize an emotion, you can change the way you feel it. So it's not instant. It's not like you just change your mind about what it means to feel awkward or something like that. But over time, if you can just keep telling yourself, yes, I'm feeling awkward, but that's not negative. That's not necessarily negative. That can just mean this is an opportunity to grow. Then it can help you really just change the way you feel when you feel awkward.
Yeah, well said. You talk about something you call the awkwardness vortex. What is the awkwardness vortex?
Yeah, there are just decades worth of studies on this in the psychological literature linking self-consciousness and nervousness. And it doesn't really matter which one comes first, but one kind of triggers the other, and they just kind of go back and forth, exacerbating each other. I mean, we've all kind of experienced this. Like if you go into a job interview and you're nervous, you just start thinking about like, oh, like what am I doing with my hands?
Yeah.
Am I sitting weird? Am I
Yeah, you become very self-conscious and self-analytical.
Exactly. And once you're feeling self-conscious, that makes you more nervous. And once you're feeling nervous, that makes you more self-conscious. Yeah, that's kind of my name for the awkwardness vortex.
The awkwardness vortex would be a great name for a band. They could be kind of a shoegaze band with zero stage presence. They wouldn't make eye contact with the audience.
God.
And all their songs would be about things like how they can't stand the sounds of their voices on their albums and stuff like that. And of course, they'd steal the title of your book for their big hit single, Cringeworthy.
And they could make up lyrics from their teenage journals.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So are there any upsides to awkwardness?
I think so. I mean, yes, I definitely think so. Well, one of them is if we are saying that it's about sensing that gap between who you think you are and how other people are seeing you, I mean, what a nice thing to be the kind of person who's sensitive to that that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It really says nice things about you. That's a really kind of pro-social instinct. And if you're sensitive to these moments, then an upside of being sensitive to that is you, when appropriate, you kind of can use this feeling to improve yourself, which I think is cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's funny. I started off writing this book as kind of a guide to banish awkwardness forever. I never wanted to feel like this again, and I wanted to just dig into the scientific literature and just come up with just ways to stop from myself from ever feeling this way again. It's an emotion that kind of reminds me of just the sheer absurdity of the human experience, you know?
Yeah.
It's these moments where we can kind of like see through the cracks of someone's impeccable self-presentation. And it's these moments where, to me, they became moments that can really lead to some true connection with each other.
Yeah, because it's something that we all share. We all experience awkwardness, as we were talking about earlier. Well, thank you for the great interview, Melissa. I feel like I didn't really push past my growing edge and go deep enough with my questions. What do you think? Or am I putting you in an awkward position by even asking this question?
I think this was great. I love talking about this. Embarrassed to be alive. Sit with my life open wide. Stare is forcing my face. Never joking.
Melissa Dahl is the author of Cringeworthy, A Theory of Awkwardness. That's it for this edition of Beta. We'd love to hear what you think of the show. You can get in touch with us by sending an email to beta@wpr.org. Special thanks to our technical director and music director, Steve Gotcher, and to executive producer, Adam Friedrich.
That does it. Out you two pixies go to the door or out the window.
And of course, a big thanks to you for listening. We'll be back next week with another hour of mirth and mayhem. And I promise that next week's show will be even better than this one. It better be better. It has to be, right? I'd offer a guarantee, but I'm a little worried. So anyway, Beta, because the first 5 days after the weekend are the hardest. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
Oh my God, what's going on with my voice? Do I sound like that playback?